The second case for oral argument this morning is Stephen Hobart versus George Farabee. George Farabee, being the appellant, is represented by Mr. Dieter Cook, an attorney from Rapid City, and the appellee, Stephen Hobart, is represented by Linda Lee Viken, also an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Cook, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Can you please the court?
Counsel.
Good morning. As you stated, my name is Dieter Cook. I'm representing the appellant and respondent in this matter, George Farabee. And briefly to outline some of the facts that brought this matter before the court, I would inform the court and the audience that this case involves two adjoining landowners who have approximately 1 mile of fence shared between them. In addition, they have Forest Service property that divides portions of their land that they share. Mr. Farabee has been on this property approximately 17 to 18 years now. He originally purchased the property, and Mr. Hobart's father was his adjoining neighbor. At that time, they got along amicably and reasonably, as neighbors do. Problems began some years later when Steve Hobart took over the property from his father's, and their relationship deteriorated to the point that it became so contentious that Mr. Hobart sought an order for protection stalking against Mr. Farabee in June of 1999. That petition was denied by the court. Mr. Hobart then filed another petition in December of the same year, and an ex parte order was granted by Judge Davis. Mr. Farabee responded by filing his own petition seeking an ex parte order for protection against stalking against Mr. Hobart. That order was also granted. And an order for protection was granted by the court in February of that year, or in March of that year. I hesitate when I say granted. It was without benefit of any hearing on the matter. And although it's claimed that it was a mutual consent, my client denies that he mutually consented to any continuance of the protection order without a hearing on it. Be that as it may, that order clearly expired in March of 2002 or 2003. And at that time, Steve Hobart, the appellee, brought another motion seeking a continuance of that order, or in the alternative, a new order for protection against stalking. The court heard testimony, received evidence, and at the conclusion entered its oral pronouncement, finding that an order of protection against Mr. Farabee was warranted under the circumstances. The reason we're here today, Your Honor, is that we disagree that the court's order was entered properly. And our first argument is that the court abused its discretion in entering the protection order, and it abused its discretion in denying our motion for a directed verdict. The testimony presented and the proper evidence before the court during that hearing clearly indicated that Mr. Farabee was not only justified in filing any complaints that were alleged to have been harassment by Mr. Hobart, but these complaints were substantiated, they served a legitimate purpose.
Are and you further, saying that the facts never occurred that were the basis for the issuance of the order, or they simply don't rise to the level, even if true, that justify an issuance of an order? Which is it?
Actually, both, Your Honor. It's a situation where the facts do not exist to meet the burden and requirements for a protection order on stalking. As the court is well aware, an order for protection of stalking, Hobart must show that Farabee's conduct falls within the definition of stalking, which is, under this circumstance, a person who willfully, maliciously, and repeatedly harasses another person by means of any verbal, electronic, digital media, mechanical, telegraphic, or written communication is guilty of the crime of stalking. and further states the stalking is a Class I misdemeanor. Clearly is not in this particular circumstance, because it's an order for protection rather than a criminal proceeding. It also defines harassment as a knowing and willful course of conduct directed at a specific person which seriously alarms, annoys, or harasses a person, and which serves no legitimate purpose. Course of conduct means a pattern of conduct composed of a series of acts over a period of time, however short, evidencing a continuity of purpose. Constitutionally protected activity is not included within the meaning of the course of conduct. Court made no finding whatsoever at any point in any of its conclusions or any of its oral pronouncements that Mr. Farabee's complaints did not serve a legitimate purpose. In fact, the evidence presented and the testimony clearly indicated that they did. There was nothing pointed to other than one two instances of involving a dam on Mr. Hobart's property and burn piles that Scott Anderson of the Pennington County Planning and Zoning Board testified to that weren't substantiated through his office. And those two instances, he indicated, were simply not within his authority to address. And he is the one that suggested to Mr. Farabee that he proceed through another governmental agency to address that concern, which he did by contacting the Corps of Engineers. Further, the court made absolutely no finding whatsoever that any of Mr. Farabee's complaints or concerns addressed to any government agency that addressed any of his concerns about Steve Hobart were not constitutionally protected speech.
Well, how about the situation or the event where your client's bull gets across the fence and gets into the neighbor's property, and the neighbor, who has a right under the law to keep the animal, feed it, and then claim a lien against the bull, puts it in its trailer and hauls it back to you, to your client, and then your client makes a complaint for transporting livestock without a license. I mean, is that justified? Does that make any sense at all?
While it may be considered overly sensitive by some people, it is a law under the state of South Dakota that a person may not haul livestock of another without his written permission.
What would you have the neighbor do? I mean, what would your client have the neighbor do? Keep the bull, feed it, and then put a lien against it? Or should he? I mean, what's wrong with bringing it back?
What he should have done, and which was appropriate under the statutes, is, as you have pointed out, is to detain the bull and contact Mr. Farabee to see whether he wants it brought back to him or whether he wants to come get it. That's the appropriate remedy. But to simply load something up and haul it off is a violation of the statutes. It may be that Mr. Hobart
found it to be a violation. That's your argument, that it was found to be a violation, but he was never charged with violating any statute.
That is another point, Your Honor. He was not charged, and there's nothing in the evidence that even indicates that Mr. Hobart was aware that he had been complained about on that until after he had filed this order for protection.
Now, I mean, this list that he's complained with is borders on unbelievable. You got the sheriff, the Forest Service, a zoning board, Senator Daschle's office, the Sierra Club, for some unknown reason, South Dakota Game and Fish, and U.S. Wildlife Service. I mean, it looks like he's just going through the telephone book trying to find anybody he can complain to this person about.
I think that is a mischaracterization, Your Honor. I do understand that there is an extensive list there, but if you look at the procedures that were followed and the progression that was done in this, Mr. Farabee objected to a snowmobile trail crossing Forest Service property. He attempted to do it the correct way, which was go to the government agency that controls that and request that they follow their very own procedures and do an environmental impact study. He was basically ignored. And so he took it to the next level. He again was ignored.
What would an environmental impact study cost?
I have no idea, Your Honor, but it probably is not a severe cost when placed in light of the damage to the environment.
Because the government pays for it?
Government would pay for it. And it is the procedure of the Forest Service to do that before building trails.
And then ultimately, as I understand it, ultimately he did prevail to some extent on that complaint. Is that right?
Excuse me?
He did prevail to some extent on that complaint about
the trail. He did, absolutely.
Okay, but I want to ask you, based on the list that the Chief Justice read, have you by chance added up the number of those complaints that resulted in some activity by the governmental entity ultimately that substantiated his complaint to some extent and the number that did not?
I have not, Your Honor, and for two reasons. First of all, that list of complaints was attached to an affidavit. There's no indication whatsoever that any of those documents, first of all, have been substantiated. Second of all, that there's any foundation laid for their authenticity. They're clearly hearsay. They were not admitted as evidence in the hearing, and they shouldn't have been considered. What was before the court on the day of the hearing was the actual testimony and the evidence produced that day. The court, it is our position, incorrectly relied on any of those documents because those documents were part of the contested facts, and my client was afforded no opportunity to cross-examine or confront any of the people that prepared them. And so part of the reason that they weren't even considered is that. The second reason is, Your Honor, as I was continuing, is he did eventually obtain some results and get part of the snowmobile closed down, but only after exhausting all of these remedies and contacting all of these various parties who would do nothing, he went to Senator Daschle's office, and subsequently it was shut down. And it was shut down because the Forest Service admitted they did not follow their own procedures. That's why it was shut down. So if it took 1,000 complaints to accomplish the correct result, he is certainly justified in doing so.
Then help me on one other thing. I'm not entirely clear whether this order was ultimately entered, the one that we're reviewing today, based on the credible threat of bodily injury or whether it was based on the harassment subdivision. I understand it to be on the harassment subdivision. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Or were both boxes checked?
Well, unfortunately, the court would not and chastise both parties at the time of the hearing from refraining from getting into the issue of any serious threat or bodily injury. And then, in fact, the court stated that it would enter no such finding. But when presented with the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law prepared by Hobart's attorney, he signed them. And in those provisions was that statement that there was a finding of threat or personal injury.
Which finding are we to review then?
I think what the court has to look at, clearly the prior holdings of the court have said that the oral pronouncements are not what they look at, but they look at what the actual written findings are. However, the court has also indicated that the written findings must comport with the evidence presented and the statements of the judge at the time of issuing his oral pronouncements. And clearly that's not the case here. And even if it were the case, Your Honor, if the court did find that and legitimately signed those, knowing that he was signing something that he had prohibited us from doing, that would clearly violate my client's right to due process to confront those issues, which we were denied.
Let's go to the more difficult question here, because I think you have the burden of showing that the court was wrong, and the court found here that your client made numerous complaints and inquiries with federal, state, and local government agencies, and a great majority of the complaints were frivolous, unfounded, and served no legitimate purpose. But my question is this: the judge's remedy was to forbid your client from making any complaint to these agencies unless he first went to the judge and paid a $25 fee and the judge decided that that complaint was legitimate. I'd like you to address the constitutionality of that.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, that is a clear violation of my right, of my client's right to redress grievances as guaranteed under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. There is a standard that the court set in Hague in addressing issues related to infringements on freedom of speech that occur during a protection order type hearing. In that, the court said that the test is whether the challenge provisions of the injunction burden no more speech than is necessary to serve a significant government interest. Clearly, the trial judge's order infringes far more speech than what is necessary. In fact, it infringes all speech to all government agencies in that list, even government agencies that are agencies of the United States government, which clearly a South Dakota trial judge would have no authority over.
If I understand what Justice Konkamp just read, though, he's not prohibited from doing anything. All he has to do is initially convince the judge his complaint is not frivolous.
Your Honor, redress delayed is redress denied. Under the judge's order as it stands right now, anybody for any reason that committed any kind of an act that was in violation of any law or rule, my client would be prohibited from contacting authorities while that act's occurring, and it can only do it upon getting his time in front of Judge Fuller along with a $25 fee.
So let me throw out this proposal and see if you agree or disagree. Even if Mr. Hobart was coming up the driveway with a rifle with the intent of killing your client, under this order, would your client still have to call Judge Fuller to get permission to call the sheriff?
Under the terms of that order, he would, Your Honor. There is no exception under that order.
He says before he can file a complaint, I suppose a telephone call isn't necessarily a filing of a complaint. Is that a possible reading of the order?
In fact, what he said was before any contact with those agencies or filing of a complaint. And clearly, there's two problems with that. The first is, as you've identified, is that he's prohibited from reporting an ongoing violation of the law. If his neighbor is cutting down Forest Service trees and Mr. Farabee observes that, under this court's order, he would basically have to just turn his head, let him cut down all the trees he wants, meanwhile file his complaint along with a $25 fee.
All right, well, let me ask you this now. Let's take the other side of this, though. If the judge is right that your client was filing all these frivolous complaints with all these agencies and that Mr. Hobart was required to respond to these, spend a lot of time answering and dealing with them in order to point out that they were frivolous, what is a person to do when this is going on, when a neighbor is intent upon making his other neighbor's life miserable by filing all these complaints? What remedy does the law provide to stop that kind of thing?
Your Honor, there's a distinction here between frivolous complaints and substantiated complaints. All of the complaints that are listed are all the complaints that George Farabee or made against Mr. Hobart that he testified to were not frivolous complaints.
All right, but I know that's your position. The judge didn't agree with you on that. The judge said that most of them were frivolous. So my question remains, what is a person to do when someone decides they're going to make their neighbor's life miserable by filing complaints with every possible agency they can think of? How do they stop it? Doesn't the law give them some remedy? And isn't that what Judge Fuller was trying to do here?
There is a built-in remedy, Your Honor, and it's built into the procedures and rules and regulations with each government agency. If the court is going to rely on these documents provided with the affidavit, the court should look at what was the occurrence. Mr. Hobart didn't even know most of these things occurred. He wasn't aware of them until he filed a Freedom of Information Act and learned that all of these things had been complained about. The reason he did not know is because the Forest Service and various government agencies, through their own rules and procedures, appropriately addressed anything that they found to be frivolous. They addressed it themselves.
So what you're saying is that Mr. Hobart's remedy is that each time he finds out that there's been yet another complaint with yet another agency, he has to respond to that complaint, point out that it's frivolous. I mean, isn't there some point where he can say, hey, look, this is the 100th frivolous complaint against me. My life, I'm spending my entire life trying to answer this man's complaints. I can't live my life. What, Judge, what can you do to prevent this? And what do you say? Judge, there's nothing he can do.
That's an extreme example, Your Honor.
I
it does
understand
not comport
that.
With the facts of this case. This case clearly indicates that the frivolous, anything that would be deemed as frivolous, was not even known to Mr. Hobart. He didn't have to respond to something that he didn't know about. Anything that he responded to, in fact, he testified, was justified. His cows were out. Every time Mr. Farabee
But you're
complained.
Arguing against what the judge found already. I mean, you're asking us to say that, first of all, that Judge Fuller was wrong in saying that there were numerous frivolous complaints. We have to agree with you on that. And then we have to agree that that unless he was right, even if he was right, Mr. Hobart has no remedy, has no protection from this repeated kind of conduct.
He, first of all, I guess my time is up.
You can answer the question if you. Yeah. I just want to know, given what Judge Fuller found, what is the remedy? What remedy does a person have to protect themselves if you're saying they can't do constitutionally what Judge Fuller did?
Under that type of a scenario, if there's been an ongoing and demonstrated series of frivolous events that have in fact impacted someone, I think the court can fashion a reasonable remedy that is tailored specifically to those events and limits speech to the least amount. Now, in the event that the actions are not frivolous, then the obvious solution is don't commit the violation.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Ms. Viking, you have 20 minutes.
Ms. Viking, before you get started, I just wanted to ask you one question. Do you represent the Hatfields or the McCoys?
Let me think about that. Unfortunately, there's some truth to that question, Your Honor, as to its characterization of this case. Chief Justice Gilbertson, honorable members of the court, counsel, may it please the court. I think Justice Konenkamp's question is one that deserves an answer and consideration. This court in State versus Asmussen held that stalking is a serious concern of society and that the plainly legitimate purpose of the stalking law was to protect people from being stalked. And one of the provisions in the stalking law is harassment, a protection from harassment. In looking at what Judge Fuller had before him and what he had to do to find a resolution, you can see the difficulty that he was faced with. When we look at the items that were before him, we see not just the things that were talked about by the appellant, but a whole list of complaints, of calls, of writing letters. And the testimony was uncontroverted that my client spent 2 to 3 times a month responding to complaints. So the ones that were talked about here today are not the only ones, and that's what part of what Judge Fuller found. The question of the affidavit and the things attached to it is a significant one. And in that regard, it should be noted that SDCL 25-19A-8.2 requires this. A petition shall be accompanied by an affidavit made under oath stating the specific facts and circumstances of the stalking.
But that's just like a complaint. I mean, when you go to trial, then the rules of evidence apply. And, you know, all the other due process that's required. I mean, that statute is simply talking about the initial petition that's filed.
I understand that, Your Honor, except what my point is that there is an affidavit required, and it has to be specific, and that's what my client did in attaching his FOIA requests. And in the trial itself, I asked the court to consider all of those items that were there. There was no objection from counsel on that question when I raised that issue. And in addition, there is discussion in the transcript from those very documents. There were questions asked. There was no objection raised to those questions when they were asked of my client and his response to some of the things that were in there. So I think those things were legitimately before the judge. There's an objection to a letter that I wrote in counsel's brief. I think it confuses a little bit. When I said it was in the record, it was part of the record, I did not mean as part of the affidavit. It's already at settled record 16 because it was previously submitted to Judge Davis at that time, who was handling the case in response to an inquiry of his. So, although I think that's a de minimis argument anyway, because I asked him the questions that related to the things that were in that letter, so there was direct testimony on that. Let me address the issue of the First Amendment petition rights. This court has held, also in Asmussen, freedom of expression is not absolute. It does not include threatening or harassing conduct. That's what Judge Fuller found was occurring. And because of that, he sought a way to limit this activity, to give my client his protection rights under the law from harassment. What he did in having a gatekeeper function, basically, was similar to what is found in other cases, particularly if you look at cases relating to the court system. And we cited in our brief the Rumble case, and there are other cases cited within it. And what in those situations is upheld for a court to set as part of an order a requirement that they can't file a complaint with the court until it's prejudged, basically, by the court, that it's legitimate. I myself have had one of those entered in a case that I was involved in. In this situation, the judge did that same thing, except he did it as it relates to agencies and other governmental
forms of government. So what happens to, take the scenario that I presented to counsel of the your client going up the road with a rifle. Can he call the sheriff and not violate this order, or does he have to call Judge Fuller first?
Well, I believe that he could call the sheriff because that is a distinct criminal matter as opposed to a complaint filed for the sole purpose of harassment, which is what Judge Fuller was aiming at.
Well, Judge Fuller doesn't say that. It just says if he wants to file a complaint, doesn't distinguish, just says he'd want to file a complaint, then Judge Fuller is going to decide whether it's frivolous or not. That's the problem, isn't it, here, that what we have, where he can't even call to protect his life. I know, I realize that's an extreme example, but I'm trying to test this order.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I think that Judge Fuller was trying as best he could to fashion a remedy that he thought would be legitimate. There were many complaints to the sheriff's office and to the local authorities, and again, my client was involved many times as a result of that. I mean, even there's testimony in the record how on the day that Mr. Farabee was served with the protection order, the temporary protection order in this case, he called to have my client arrested for driving by his house. The judge was struggling to find a way. Now, that particular complaint obviously was not raised as a concern on behalf of the respondent in this case. And I will say also that as it relates to the credible threat, if I can skip a second to that question that was asked, there was a proposal made to the court about a credible threat, and that was because of the testimony that my client gave to the court concerning guns and threats and things that had gone on. There was counsel for Mr. Farabee did object to that, and the court determined that it would insert that. And this court has held.
You know, I know. I read the transcript again last night, and it says the judge says, "I'm not going to deal with this credible threat stuff because it really wasn't brought up and so I'm not going to do anything about that. But apparently, in between the time that he said that and the time that you presented him with the findings, he went ahead and signed the findings. Is that what happened?
Apparently so, Your Honor. In Marks versus Clark, this court said it's well-established law that a judge's extraneous comments or oral proclamations in court do not control. What the judge actually signs as his legal finding is what this court looks to. And so I can just tell you that that's the best I can offer to the court.
I have a question on the remedy here. Wouldn't it have, if the harassing activity was the basis of the protection order, and the remedy is fashioned to that, I too am concerned that maybe the court went a little too far here. Wouldn't it have been just as appropriate and more in line with what normally we give as far as a remedy in a protection order to just order him not to file any other frivolous complaints or to make phone calls to the sheriff's office complaining about frivolous things? And then if your client then was made aware of these and thought they were frivolous, it would be your opportunity to come in and complain about it, just as it is when we say you cannot come near somebody or threaten them. I mean, I don't see that. I would see that that was not stepping over the boundary of preventing any First Amendment rights, but yet would be a remedy that would give your client an opportunity to come in and show that it's being...
I think, Your Honor, I understand that question, and I've thought about that myself. If you look at the history of this case, because there are prior proceedings in the case which are in the record, the concern that I would have about that is, first of all, that puts the burden on my client every time he thinks that situation has occurred to file a criminal complaint and then have a beyond a reasonable doubt question raised, instead of getting the benefits of the law, which is designed to prevent improper action. So I think that was the dilemma that the court found itself in. It would be simple to do what you have suggested, but the problem is, in this particular case, I'm not sure it would have been effective at all, number one, and secondly, would have instead made my client the victim, so to speak, instead of being protected by the law. And I think that's what Judge
But in almost any protection order, you, fortunately or unfortunately, the person who requests the protection order and receives it to their benefit always has to bring it to law enforcement's attention or bring it back to the court for a contempt of court analysis. I mean, even if it's, you can't threaten, you can't do phone calls, you can't contact them in any way through third parties, that puts the burden on the person that sought the protection order to bring it back to court.
Yes, Your Honor, but in those instances, it's pretty clear to determine whether there's a violation. If you can't call and you call, that's a violation. If you file a complaint and another complaint and another complaint and somebody comes out to talk to you time after time again, that's not as easy to determine. And I think that's what Judge Fuller was trying to do, is saying, I'm going to try to stop those that are clearly inappropriate before they get into the system.
No,
it's not an easy case, Your Honor.
He's trying to stop all of them, those that are permissible and those that are impermissible, isn't he?
No, Your Honor.
By requiring it to be prejudged and to be requiring a $25 fee to be paid?
He is not prejudging.
I mean, that applies to permissible ones and impermissible ones, doesn't it? In other words, whether it's frivolous or not.
Yes, he requires a payment of a fee when it's filed, but then if he determines that it is not frivolous, then he returns the $25. So it's not, he doesn't have to pay for everyone. And that's, you know, and that's a good point, Your Honor. What the court was trying to do is not stop his right to file, but it was to stop frivolous matters and repetitious matters. In some of the cases we've cited, when it talks about the court system, talk about repeated and repeated filings.
But the remedy covers permissible and impermissible actions, not just impermissible ones. It doesn't cover just frivolous actions, it covers all actions.
The preclearance by the judge, the gatekeeping by the judge, does affect all of those complaints
right.
filed.
And the deposit of the fee, maybe he's got a chance of getting it back, but that covers all actions.
That's correct, Your Honor, it does.
And to follow up on that, As you're well aware, you know, the First Amendment freedom of speech guarantees are very precious, and the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the remedy must be narrowly tailored to meet the specific problem. And based on your exchange with Justice Sabers just now, it seems to me that no matter what the intentions of Judge Fuller, that he's gone beyond a narrowly tailored remedy, because it's also encompassed legitimate complaints that might be filed.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing I can analogize to are those series of cases that talk about when the court does that kind of a prejudgment. It's the same thing. If the prohibition is that I cannot file an action until the judge says, after reviewing it, that it's legitimate, I think that's analogous to what Judge Fuller was trying to do here in this case. And the United States Supreme Court has also said that the right to petition is not unlimited, and the First Amendment rights are not unlimited. And when they're used for the purposes of harassment or for an improper motive, then the court can look at that. Just, and on the issue of improper motive, there was a question asked about the Bull situation. And it should be remembered that the transcript shows that not only was this a complaint which seems at worst, unneighborly, but it also, the transcript also reveals that when Mr. Farabee called to have my client arrested for stealing the bull, he never even bothered to report it after he found the bull. So what's the motive here? I think it's pretty clear in this conduct, and that's the course of conduct. And also remember that the court judged the credibility of the witnesses in this case. And this court has said that in looking at those kinds of things, that we give great deference to what the court finds. And in the case of findings in this area of the law, the court is to, just almost as in a summary judgment, if to assume the facts are favorable to, in this case, the petitioner, when the court finds that there is a credible, in this case, harassment based upon the
If we were to follow and agree that there is enough evidence here for the harassment finding, but then find that perhaps the remedy went too far, infringing upon First Amendment rights, what would you request this court to do then? Would we remand it? Is this something that we could then pare the remedy down so that it was acceptable? What kind of a, if we were to find that this goes too far, what remedy would meet the First Amendment rights?
Well, clearly a pre-screening can meet constitutional rights, because there are plenty of cases that say that in the context of the judicial setting. The difficulty is exactly what you've articulated, several of you have, about what about this instance. Obviously, I believe that the record supports the court's decision that harassment occurred and that there needed to be a remedy. Obviously, if the court feels that the circuit court has gone too far, my request would be to remand it with some specific guidelines. And I think in doing that, obviously that will help the court, and maybe some issues that this court has thought about that were not brought to the court's attention at that time. I think the court will find it difficult, because frankly, on my way over here, I was trying to think of, assuming you might ask me that question, I was trying to think of the answer. And I don't know what to suggest, except that we must find a way to end the conduct. And pre-clearing is not constitutionally inappropriate. Our Supreme Court has held that baseless litigation is not immunized by the First Amendment right to petition. And that's what we believe is happening here. When you look time and time again, and you take the uncontroverted testimony of two or three times a month, my client is responding to things.
I question whether or not the South Dakota Supreme Court should, get involved in devising the remedy that you suggest. Isn't our job, for the benefit of the state of South Dakota, just to say, no, circuit court judge, you went too far here, do it over, get it right, and you solve the problem. I mean, I guess I'm not inclined to let these people, you know, occupy the time of the court in coming up with a remedy for them under these circumstances. So I think at best it's the circuit court judge's job.
I understand that, Your Honor, but you can obviously give guidance to the court if you are concerned that he has been overly broad in the agencies or the kinds of complaints that might arise, and take that into consideration. It was a difficult case, I think, for the circuit court, for the very reasons that we've talked about. Even if you look at my initial remarks to the court at the beginning of that hearing, I was struggling with the same questions we are doing today. But I did feel that the court came up with a solution that at least made some sense. It was a way to stop and filter some of the things that had gone on. I mean, if you look, for example, just some issues like...
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you have things like the burn permit, how many times do we get asked about that? Requests for, does he have a hauling permit? Does he have this? Does he, you know, all of this is aimed at my client. You know, while some of it is legitimate in the sense that, yes, can he ask about environmental damage, etc. But, you know, look at some of the things like, you know, allegedly my client's cows were hurting the bottom of the stream, and there was never any proof of that. But he hung on to that 3 or 4 different times, even when he was told by the agencies that there was nothing. So there has to be some remedy here that can give my client the benefits of the statute. A right without a remedy is meaningless. When the legislature has said, you have a right not to be harassed, and when the court finds, I think very legitimately, that there's been harassment, we have to have a method of dealing with it. And the circuit judge did what I believe is an appropriate order, that is, a preclearance, a gatekeeping function.
I wonder if the legislature ever envisioned this kind of a dispute. I think when they enacted this law, it was to protect battered women, not to fighting ranchers, but obviously the law applies to them as well.
Well, Your Honor, I actually was the prime sponsor of the stalking law, and I can tell you that there was some discussion about some peripheral things, but you're right, that was one of the main functions. But I also note that the legislature, as I recall, and I was going to look it up and I apologize I didn't do that, but they actually broadened this law from the way it was written to put in this harassment. So the legislature clearly had something more in mind than just domestic violence, because we have domestic violence statutes. So thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Viken. Mr. Cook, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The appellee attorney referenced Rosenbaum as a case that supports her position that the courts can tailor appropriate remedies to prevent frivolous lawsuits. And that's correct. The court can do that. But in Rosenbaum, the court was required to show that there were prior frivolous lawsuits and that previous sanctions were not effective in controlling that. And the court made no mention of trying to prohibit redress of grievance through other government agencies. That's clearly embodied in the separation of powers.
What, was there any restraint on his frivolous complaints in the prior? There was another protection order that had run out previously. Was there anything in those protection orders that said he couldn't do this?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so there were no prior restraints or orders against him that it was obvious to the court didn't work?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. The court simply cannot substitute his knowledge for the knowledge of all government agencies. It would be no more appropriate for him to do that than it would be for Governor Rounds to prohibit me from bringing an action in circuit court that he thought was perhaps frivolous. That's the purpose of separation of powers. The court does not control government agencies, other government agencies. They have procedures to address whether or not something's frivolous. They have the expertise to determine whether or not appropriate procedures were followed. It's apparent that if Mr. Farabee brought an action or wished to bring an action and filed his request to file a complaint with Judge Fuller, clearly Judge Fuller would have to do exactly the same thing that Farabee would do. Submit this proposal to the various agencies to see if it has merit.
I'm going to ask you the same question. If we disagree with you and find that there was evidence here to substantiate a protection order because of harassment, and that this multiple filings and callings and complainings and so forth constitute harassment under the statute, but if we agree with you that this remedy is too broad and does infringe on his First Amendment rights, what kind of a remedy is the court left with?
I believe the court would have its remedies in controlling a very narrow behavior, in that, as I think you were absolutely correct, that the court could perhaps say that you will not file frivolous lawsuits, clearly, or frivolous complaints. Clearly, it's our position that none of our complaints have ever been frivolous. And I don't believe there's any evidence.
That wouldn't be much help, would it? If your client believe that nothing he's ever done has been frivolous or unfounded, as a judge found, then prohibiting him from continuing that is useless because your client doesn't believe he's done anything frivolous.
I think that's a fair statement. If he's not filing frivolous actions, then clearly the court has no authority to prevent him from doing that. I think it's also incumbent that this court review its finding in the Hague matter, wherein this court drew a distinction between use of a public entity and harassment that was perhaps addressed to a more an individual. The court recognized that harassment directed at an individual in the sanctity of their home is a far different and far greater danger and a much more significant governmental interest than someone simply petitioning and using an open forum to perhaps say the same thing. And there is case law that was cited, the Anisoff case, that clearly indicates that a person has a fundamental right to petition a grievance, and they have the fundamental right to use government agencies, even if it is contrary to the interests of their neighbor or another party. Now, that is an antitrust action, and it says that if the harassment goes to the extent that the other party is prevented from using the same right to petition for redress, then it goes too far. But it clearly does not limit any person's ability to access government entities for purposes of gaining an advantage or perhaps limiting someone else's ability to obtain a permit, as Mr. Hobart has claimed is harassment. Those kinds of things are constitutionally protected activity. The other thing in Hague that is not reached by this court, but I do believe is necessary, is there must be a finding. There must be a finding that this served no legitimate purpose and that it was not constitutionally protected speech. Those findings were not made by the court. If those findings are not made, it does not meet the level of scrutiny required by the statutes, and it must fail. Counsel also alleged that other documents were considered by the court, and I did not object to those. I did object to the Forest Service documents, one alluded to by her client. That was clear. The other documents were never offered. There simply is no burden on me to object to documents that are not offered into evidence. The court can't consider those as evidence if they haven't been offered, if they haven't been accepted, if they haven't shown that they overcome the hearsay exception, if they haven't been proven to be a proper foundation for their
admissibility. Ms. Viken says that she asked the court to consider the documents that were in the file, apparently the affidavit. And there was no objection raised. Are you taking issue with that?
That's not a proper evidentiary foundation for laying a document into evidence.
No, she said that she asked the court to consider it, and you didn't object, so apparently the court considered it.
I am not aware of that occurring.
Okay.
Now, it's perhaps that it did, and it's in the transcript somewhere, but I'm not aware of that. And certainly had I been made aware of that through a proper evidentiary foundation, I would have objected, and I did object where appropriate. And the court sustained my objection. But then the court turns around and relies on those documents in fashioning some sort of a remedy that encompasses numerous government entities over which it really has no place diving into. I do agree that a court could fashion a remedy that simply says you're prohibited from making frivolous complaints for the sole purpose of harassing your neighbor that served no legitimate purpose and that aren't constitutionally protected free speech. I believe he could do that. He did not. In fact, he never even made any finding that this was not constitutionally protected and that it was, and it did not serve a legitimate purpose. The evidence presented through Scott Anderson clearly indicates that it was, or it did serve a legitimate purpose. It identified numerous instances of violations. In fact, Hobart himself acknowledges that the only way he became aware that he was in violation of these ordinances and variances and conditional use permit is because Farabee pointed it out. So it clearly served a legitimate purpose. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cook. Court would note also that we had students from Arlington High School, Dakota Wesleyan University Journalism class, and Mitchell Technical Student Institute, and welcome them. We will be in recess for 10 minutes.